To Midday, I'm Melanie Summers, sitting in today for Gary Eichten. Candidates on the Independence Party ballot for the U.S. Senate are gearing up for the September primary. Four candidates are vying for the right to run against incumbent Republican Rod Grams and the chosen Democratic candidate. The Independence Party's endorsed candidate is software entrepreneur James Gibson, environmental activist Leslie Davis, frequent candidate Fred Askew, and former party official Buford Johnson are challenging Gibson for the nomination. As part of our continuing Meet the Candidate series, we'll talk this morning with Buford Johnson. Mr. Johnson is former vice chair of the Independence Party. He resigned that post at the state convention in order to run for the U.S. Senate. Mr. Johnson is a financial advisor and stockbroker in the Brainerd Lakes area and is an adjunct faculty member at Central Lakes Community College in Brainerd. Buford Johnson has run for federal office before. In 1968, he was the DFL-endorsed candidate for Congress in the old 6th Congressional District. He lost to John Zwack. And in 1994, he ran in the DFL primary for the U.S. Senate against Ann Winia. Mr. Johnson, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Naomi.
How are you today?
Appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Well, tell us, first of all, why you've decided to run for the U.S. Senate.
Well, I have a tremendous love for this country. I served in the armed forces, and I think people who served overseas, especially in combat, have a realization that we have a fantastic nation. And it's our responsibility to make sure it stays that way. And I see some major problems, and they're not being addressed, and I decided they need to be addressed, and I'm running on some of those issues.
What are some of those major problems?
Well, the major problem is the fact that we have two political parties that have become what I'll call money-hungry and power-hungry, and they've lost the sense of serving the people. We have two parties that are bought. So as Jim Hightower said in his book, if the gods wanted you to vote, they'd have given you candidates. Basically, he said, people say we need a third party. He said, I wish we had two parties. The same interest groups are buying both parties. We created a legal system, what I'll call bribery, in which organizations contribute money to the candidates and to the parties in an organized fashion. We created a soft money situation where you can give millions to the parties. And what's happened is access to Congress in Washington, D.C. Now, Minnesota is a unique state. We're pretty up and above board. But nationwide, if you want access, you better donate your money. Even the lobbyists are complaining about it. Because we went from legalized bribery to what I call extortion. You read several other books that you want to pick up that will cover the same subject. But Elizabeth Drew's book on the corruption of American politics, or even Huffington's, who's a Republican, How to Overthrow the Government book, talk about the fact that legislators put the pressure on lobbyists to dump more money into the party coffers when their bills come up. And in fact, there's allegations that congressmen actually hold up on passing of legislation in order they can get a couple more million out of the lobbyists. The lobbyists don't like it. You know, when I talk to some lobbyists, they have ideas they want to deal with, and basically, it's money up first, mm-hmm. And it's not our government. We've lost it. And
how would the Independence Party be different in terms
of... Well, the party itself says, you know, no strings attached. The money's not going to drive the issue. And I really believe, I don't care how you change the laws, because the laws we have came about because of campaign reforms in 72. I really believe that we have to have our campaign standards set by the parties and by the candidates. And I don't see it. We created a condition in which, I don't care how good a candidate you are in a Democratic or Republican party, it's irrelevant. It's like walking through a pig pen. When you walk through, you're going to stink. Even Senator Wellstone, whom I had a lot of respect for, and I come out of the DFL tradition, I'm proud of our old tradition, even Senator Wellstone, who said no PAC money after election, ended up receiving PAC money. I mean, he had to capitulate. That's part of the structure. And I think somehow we have to have people in office that say, wait a minute, enough's enough. Senator McCain was campaigning through the Republican Party saying, hey, we have some problems in our finance structure, for the party access. And he knows it's wrong. And yet he's staying loyal to the Republicans. The problem I had, and this is what happened to me, you got this problem between loyalty and what has to be right. And, I was always a DFLer. I oftentimes disagreed with where they were going and what they were doing, but by George, I was a DFLer. But there's a point in time when what's right and your loyalty come into conflict. And I said, oh, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. I left the party, became an independent.
And you resigned your vice chairmanship your post as vice chair of the party to run for the U.S. Senate.
Right.
And why did you decide to take that step?
Well, there were a couple issues, and the one was, as I said, the big issue that they weren't being addressed, and that was the campaign finance. Several other big issues for me is the fact that it seems like this nation's become addicted to government. I mean, every time we turn around, they want the government to become involved in more and more of our life. And the strength of America is not in government. The strength of America is in our churches and our communities and the affiliations and associations we have. I mean, that's the way it was set up and designed. And no one's addressing that particular part of the problem. So I said, well, you know, we have to talk about reality. And another big issue for me, and no one was addressing it, was a comprehensive health care package. And I say no one else is addressing it. I'm listening to other candidates, and they have piecemeal things. And I appreciate Mark Dayton's concern about the cost of drugs. People talk about national health insurance. Well, a federally government-driven health insurance system, to me, scares the living daylights out of me. We need a system that's not Canadian, not European, but a truly American system. And I have a whole different approach to health care, I guess, than the others do.
Well, let me give out our phone numbers for our listeners to join in, and then we can talk a little bit more detail about your health care plan. We are listening this morning to Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. Our guest is Buford Johnson. He's an Independence Party candidate for the U.S. Senate, running against three other Independence Party candidates in the September primary. We hope that you're... have some interest already in this race, even though it's the middle of summer. Sometimes people don't pay attention to politics until later in the summer, but we've got a lot of interesting candidates who are running for this office, and we hope that you might have a question or a comment for Mr. Johnson this morning. Our telephone numbers in the Twin Cities are 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Anywhere else you're listening, it's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. You're listening to Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Melanie Summer, sitting in today for Gary Eichten. Mr. Johnson, can you tell us a little bit more about your comprehensive health care package as you described it?
Well, I throw it out for discussion, mm-hmm. And I think it's an issue that has to be discussed in total in terms of the big picture versus some, you know, small items that people are addressing here and there.
Right.
First of all, I look to the states. Who's responsible for the delivery system? The states license the doctors, they license the hospitals, they license the medical schools, and they license the insurance companies. So the states should have, and properly so according to the Constitution, should have responsibility for what I'll call the medical delivery system. They should also have responsibility for what I call preventative health care. And let's go from there. I believe in private insurance companies. I sold health care insurance. I still do, but I'm licensed to, but it gets very frustrating. Most of the companies I sold for are no longer selling healthcare insurance in Minnesota. We ended up with a healthcare system designed by special interests, and it was not a comprehensive package, nor did it address all our needs. So what I'm saying is for healthcare insurance, I want competitive healthcare in the state. The insurance company is regulated by the states, and I want a pool of citizens for each state to be considered rather than a small group for the health care cost. In other words, when an insurance company came in, they would have to look at the whole pool of health in the state of Minnesota rather than for a small company or a small group. So there's no underwriting. Underwriting is based upon, except for the state population. And with that in mind, I can't denied health care. In other words, my physical conditions are relevant. The only thing they could charge for would be age and sex. And go beyond that, then everyone is going to have health care. They pick their own company. So the question is, how can you afford this? Well, we got two other things I want included in this. First of all, it's all going to be pre-tax. And right now, if you're in a major corporation, you have a cafeteria plan, it's all pre-tax. If you're working for a small business company, chances are it's not. If you're an individual, a portion of it is pre-tax. But basically, this will open up employment all over the state. A lot of people are tied into their jobs because they can't move because of health insurance and health insurance costs. But in addition to the health insurance from private companies, everyone will maintain, just almost like Social Security, a medical savings account. And that, again, a pre-tax. It's almost like your Roth IRA or your regular IRA. You will build a savings account to be used for medical use, for paying down deductibles, for disability insurance, something most people don't have and should, for long-term and home health care. And, these are the things you can use your medical savings account for. And the other big issue for me in this whole arena is when I have health insurance, I'm going to have mental health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
We have some serious problems in that area, and we solve our problem in Minnesota by sending most of these young kids that have mental health problems to jail, because of their anger and their behavioral patterns. But I guess I go beyond that. It's got to be a system that people can access and know that they're going to have the coverage and they're going to have proper care. It bothered me, and really it turned me on this issue when I saw a cartoon not too long ago. It might have been in your newspaper, the King of It, or in the paper for the Tribune. The King of It, the little king comes down, and the wizard is standing there, and he's working with a big bat. And the king said, "What are you doing?" And the wizard said, "I'm creating a potion to prevent aging." And the king says, "Well, I thought that's what HMOs were for." And ironically, it's funny because it's partially true, and that's a system we have. I want a system that responds to people, and people have a choice of where they go, the doctors they have, the hospitals they use, and take care of it in that manner.
Can I just ask for some clarification?
Sure.
You're talking about the state being responsible for this and setting up private insurance coverage. Are you saying that employers would no longer be responsible for providing health care benefits?
They can assist if they want. It's part of a package, or they can increase the salary. But everyone will carry a private health insurance card. Everyone. And right now, basically, if you're poor, you go to Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm, that doesn't bother me. We don't have to go to Medicaid. We can provide insurance coverage in a subsidized manner. It's the only role I have for the federal government is a voucher system for low income. And that voucher would include access money to go into the medical savings account. If people chose not to do the medical savings account, it'd be an automatic check off on their taxes. It would show up and say, This is your tax. If money is going to go into a medical savings account, you don't want to take care of it, we will. But primarily, you're responsible.
And how would you say that private insurance companies would participate in this sort of thing if, as you just noted, so many of them
the government set up a system now where small companies can't compete. They can't create HMOs and PPOs. It wasn't in the making. Small companies, were pushed out. I want it competitive. I want companies to come back in. If I know I have a base to work from, it'd be a statewide base. And I also believe there should be limits on the insurance company. And after that, the government can pick up. For example, if you have a $2 million, $3 million limit, the insurance companies know they have a limit on each case. They can do their actuarial figures that way. Anything over $2 or $3 million, the government can kick in. We have Medicare right now. That could be tied into the same system with a voucher of, I don't know what the cost would be. I think the average cost is like $6,000 a year. But the voucher could be set up for $6,000 a year for senior citizens. They can have an insurance all the way through. But the big issue, we talk about being on a fast track to prosperity. We are, except we didn't put that bridge in along that track, and that bridge is our medical system. We have some long-term care problems coming up. Senior citizens, we have more and more of them. We haven't really addressed that problem. And it's going to be a costly fiasco if we don't address it pretty soon. And if a young person, say in their 20s, say 30s and 40s, start buying long-term care insurance, by the time they're 55 or 60, it's prepaid. And it's not that expensive. It's just like normal health care. I really believe a single person, single male about age 40, would end up with good health care coverage if it were not underwritten, but based upon a state, would run $40, $50 a month, a lot cheaper than they're paying right now.
We are talking this morning with Buford Johnson, who is an Independence Party candidate for the U.S. Senate. And we're talking primarily about the issues of most importance to him, one of which is health care, another of which is the influence of the two-party system. We're wondering what you have to say about the Independence Party as a viable alternative for you or for other folks that you know in terms of this political campaign season. 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Anywhere else you're listening, it's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Do you think it's important for the Independence Party to be involved in this campaign for the U.S. Senate coming up this fall? Do these the candidates in this party have much of a chance of influencing the outcome? Do you think that it's important to introduce other candidates outside of the two-party system? Please give us a call here on Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Mr. Johnson, one of the other things that people have been talking about, candidates have been talking about in terms of health care expenses, is the cost of prescription drugs. Of course, there are some candidates who are saying that we should adopt more of a Canadian-style system where many of these drugs are far less expensive to buy in Canada than they are in the United States. What do you think should be done about the high cost of prescription drugs?
See, that's not the issue. The issue is we don't have a comprehensive health care package where people buy proper insurance and are covered. And so what happens is we get sidetracked on what I'll call, sub-issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important issue, I grant that, but it's a part of a much bigger picture until this political arena of ours starts addressing the bigger picture so that we have some vision, some insight into the problem. We're not going to address the problem. We're putting out fires, one fire after another. Today it's drugs. Tomorrow it's going to be long-term care. It's going to be home health care. It's a high cost of keeping people in prison who have mental problems. We have to address the whole thing and come up with a comprehensive package that'll take care of it. We have to keep ourselves focused, and we don't do that. We jump from point to point, and that's because politicians are driven by a quick fix, and it's their nature. And my nature is to look at the big problem. That's what I enjoy doing. First question I asked about something, what is the real problem? And the high cost of drugs is not the real problem. It's much bigger than that.
We have Elizabeth online from Sioux Falls who'd like to join the conversation. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm sorry, I'm not really familiar with the Independence Party. I'm calling from Sioux Falls in South Dakota, but I'm a physician here, and I want to make a comment about the health care proposal. The first is that any government intervention in health care unfortunately encourages inefficiency and a bureaucracy that you can't believe, and I'll give the VA medical system as an example of that. But my comment is I think that getting medical people involved in the issues of health care and economics is going to be more important than trying to get the government to fix the problem, because I know personally of a lot of inefficiencies, a lot of things which don't seem right, in terms of the cost of procedures, the cost of medical, not to mention drug therapy, but even medical consultations and medical opinions. And I think that unless people get physicians and the medical community involved in coming up with a program, you really don't begin to understand exactly how much effort and work this would take. But ultimately, I agree entirely, the healthcare system in the United States is a disaster. It's the most technologically advanced, and it's the most expensive and really scary to be in as a patient, I think.
I really appreciate her comments. And when I talk to medical people, they don't like the system. I talk to patients, they don't understand the system. She said it all. I really appreciate what she had to say. And I think, this thing has to be opened up to discussion. I don't sit here as a guru and know all the answers. I'm throwing out what I call a plan. The principles I want is make sure that we're not driven by the federal government. I use the VA system. I know what bureaucracy is all about. And it doesn't work. It's not responsive to the needs of the people. I'd like to hire her for my campaign staff.
Well, but I do think one of the things that Elizabeth was saying is that getting government involved in any way, even though you were just talking about the state governments being involved, there's going to be some government oversight.
Well, there is, in that the government's license the doctors, they license mm-hmm. the hospital. So the number of doctors and nurses that we have is pretty much regulated by the government. But they also license the facilities to make sure they meet certain standards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the normal function for the state. Their function isn't to go in and run the bureaucracy or to dictate rules and regulations internally. And this is where what I'll call the spirit of the people that do those things should come into play.
And the other thing that I have been thinking about as we've been talking about this is your concern about addressing our health care system in a comprehensive fashion. President Clinton tried that several years ago. Obviously, his plan was very heavily focused on the federal role in that, but nevertheless, his approach was to take a look at every aspect of the health care system.
Well, see, I disagree with that in total.
Okay.
The man and the party and the money drove the whole. The issue was there. The people, you know, so it was a political issue. But what drove the system and their solutions was not a comprehensive plan of the general welfare. What drove the system was the financial influence of major participants. And that financial interest, it didn't come from the rank and file and from a handful of doctors. It came from major insurance companies. And I'm not against any insurance business. I sell insurance. I look at the funding that went into the Democratic Party and the drive that it took and the direction it went. We have a medical system driven by special interest. And it's one of the issues that just scares the living daylights out of me because, you know, we'll go on from the medical along the, you know, concept of special interest, our foreign affairs, our military matters, driven by special interests, and we have some serious problems. And it's going to permeate down. It's going to affect my kids and my grandkids, and we've got to break that cycle. We need a comprehensive foreign policy. We haven't had a decent foreign policy, a direction in 12 years. And I come out of the military. I served, and I retired after 28 years of service to include reserve time. Friends of mine telling me, hey, we're getting equipment and things we don't need. They're driven by special interests. They're not driven by what our mission is. I look at the whole anti-defense missile system, and my question is, you know, I'm not sitting here with all the internal data, but my question is, as a citizen and what I know what's going on, is this nuclear or this defense system we're trying to build against rogue nations for nuclear weapons, is that driven by special interest money? Or is it driven by a real need? Because a threat is not nuclear weapons. A threat is biological and chemical. And any nation that's going to be, you know, dumb enough to try to take us on isn't going to do it in the open with a missile. They want it done so that no one knows where it came from. So I look at these things and I say, well, wait a minute. We have some serious problems in this nation. We're talking billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars being spent that we're paying for, and it's not in our national interest.
And how as an independent party senator, if you were to be elected to the Senate, how would you, as an individual in the U.S. Senate, address those issues? I mean, 99 of your colleagues will be Republicans or Democrats.
You sound like a general. I said to me, my nickname in the Army was Butch. Butch, you can't change the world. One man can't change the world. I don't believe that. I was trying to get some reform in the unit we were in. But anyway...
way back in those days, too.
Oh, yeah, same. I haven't changed. There's a sense of direction and there's a sense of what has to be done and should be done. And someone has to speak up. If not me, who? It's kind of like the, we really celebrated the, not in terms of a happy celebration, but in terms of a respectful celebration, you know, the attack on Normandy Beach. And not all the soldiers that went to Normandy Beach got there. A lot of them died in the water. All those that got to Normandy Beach didn't make it to Berlin. But someone has to start. And what can one senator do? You set an example. You set an example. You become a catalyst, just like our governor, and I think we have a great one in Governor Jesse Ventura. Just like our governor set the example. No strings attached. And all of a sudden, people are looking at this and saying, hey, you don't have to have millions to run for office. And this is one of the reasons I'm running in my own party against the endorsed candidate. It's not that I don't like Jim Gibson. I have a great deal of respect for him. But I want to develop. I want to see. And it can only come from Minnesota. We have the most open, progressive political system in the state. Or not the state, in the nation. I mean, I have a tremendous respect for the politics of Minnesota. It's above board. And our parties in the state of Minnesota, I have a lot of respect for both of them. But nationally is where I have my problem. But I want to see an independence party that allows people to come out of different walks of life, be it a doctor, a nurse, a teacher, an employer, an employee, a student just graduating from college or some university, saying, I'd like to give a part of my life to my country, and I can serve in office. I have the ability. And come in and be able to run a short campaign, be encouraged and welcomed in the party without having to have worked your way up in the party process, and then what I wanted was a multiple endorsement system where we might endorse four or five candidates or three candidates. each candidate coming in would be in, you know, be a separate ballot for that individual. If they could get 60% of the convention vote, we'd say, yes, we think this is a good person. Listen to them. So I want to see our party in Minnesota open to the public. And the only way it's open to the public is through the primary system. I don't want to see us closed off. The endorsement system becomes a system in which you have to spend a lot of time and money. I've been there, and I've done this, going after endorsement. I spend more money in 68 going after endorsement than I spend on the primary and general election combined. It takes a year and a half to get that endorsement. That's time-consuming. I want to see an open process in which people, because of their abilities and their knowledge and their issues, come forward, not because of a special group that they can pack into a convention and win nominations.
Our guest this morning is Buford Johnson. He's an Independence Party candidate for the U.S. Senate. The primary will be held in September, and Mr. Johnson will be competing against three other Independence Party representatives for the nomination coming up in September. We are interested in knowing what questions you might have to ask Mr. Johnson. What do you think the influence of the Independence Party should be on the U.S. Senate race? Is it good to have third-party alternatives to the Democrats and the Republicans? Do you feel as though the Independence Party is an important aspect of our political scene here in Minnesota? Other particular issues that you'd like to ask Mr. Johnson about, give us a call at 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities. Anywhere else you're listening, it's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. You're listening to Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Melanie Summers, sitting in for Gary Eichten. We will continue our conversation in just a couple of minutes after we hear the latest in the news from Patty Marsicano.
Thanks, Melanie. Good morning. President Clinton is assessing prospects for a Mideast peace deal on day 14 of the Camp David talks. He's been meeting with his own team of negotiators after talks with the Israelis and Palestinians. Clinton rejoined the summit last night after returning from the G8 summit in Japan. The U.S. military has issued an apology to South Korea for dumping formaldehyde into a river at a Seoul military base, a river that's the main source of drinking water for Seoul's 12 million people. U.S. officials say the formaldehyde was treated in the sewage system and diluted with wastewater. Still, the military promises appropriate corrective action. About a dozen South Korean activists protested the dumping today. Texas Governor George W. Bush remains in seclusion in his ranch, but he's expected back at the governor's mansion later today. He's returning from a weekend in which he had promised to look long and hard at his vice presidential candidates. Bush might announce his selection tomorrow or Wednesday. Signs continue to point to former Defense Secretary Dick Cheney. In regional news, the Ventura Administration's Rural Summit 2000 opens today in Rochester. The summit will explore new strategies for rural development in the 21st century. Some 500 people are expected to attend, but Governor Ventura won't be there because he's celebrating his wedding anniversary. Ventura will issue a statement and make a video greeting to summit participants. He's sending 10 of his top commissioners to the conference. The kidnapping and murder trial of Donald Blum enters its third week today in Virginia. The prosecution will call to the stand several of the investigators who worked on the case. Last week's proceedings focused on the small bits of physical evidence in the case. Blum is accused of kidnapping and killing Katie Poyer last year. The state weather forecast for today, partly cloudy skies, a chance of thunderstorms in the west and central parts of the state, the highs in the lower to mid-80s. In Bemidji, it's 75. In Duluth, it's 72. In Rochester, it's 75. In St. Cloud, it's 76. And in the Twin Cities, it's 76. That's the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.
Thanks, Patty. Programming on NPR is supported by Metropolitan State University, dedicated to providing excellence in education for working adults. Minneapolis Open House, August 2nd, St. Paul, August 3rd. We hope you'll stay tuned for the second hour of Midday coming up at noon today. We will broadcast a documentary first aired in 1988 from the radio series Beyond Affliction, the Disability History Project. The project takes a look at the experiences of people with disabilities and their families since the 19th century, and it's called What's Work Got to Do With It? That's coming up after noon today in commemoration of the fact that the Americans with Disabilities Act celebrates its 10th anniversary this week. Right now, we're continuing our conversation here on Midday with Buford Johnson, the Independence Party candidate for the U.S. Senate. He will be competing against three other candidates for the Independence Party nomination in the September primary. We'd like to know what you think about the Independence Party in general and Mr. Johnson in particular. If you have questions you'd like to ask him about particular issues of importance to you, commentary on the importance of the Independence Party in the political scene here in Minnesota. Give us a call at 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities. Anywhere else you're listening, it's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Mr. Johnson, we have Rick on the line from Minneapolis who'd like to join the conversation. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You're talking about the health care plan, and as I was listening, it occurred to me that there's I think pretty much everyone agrees there's in the area of 40 million uninsured right now. And your guest said that the one thing he thought the federal government could be useful for, and this would be to force people essentially by passing a law saying that you had to get insurance. Now, some of that would be covered by vouchers. I assume a good share of those 40 million. But I guess my point is that seems like a windfall to me for the insurance industry because that's going to be 40 million new policies that they're going to get to sell.
Rick, thanks for the call. Mr. Johnson?
I have no problem with the windfall, and here's the reason why. I don't want the government funding the whole thing in terms of becoming the insurer. If I have private insurance companies, they're going to be competitive. And how do they keep their costs down? By good investments, which money is going back into our society and into our economy. So they have an adequate reserve. The states control that, but the amount of reserve they have to have. But so that they have a reserve that's invested in our communities and in our economy. And I'd rather have it go through a private sector than a government sector. We call it windfall. I call it a two-prong success ratio. The patients, or I'll say the recipients of the insurance policy, will win, and the economy will win. We're recycling this money back into the economy. Someone's going to make money. I don't want it to be a handful of bureaucrats, and that's what we have now. And I fear that. This top-down solution that the government can solve these problems absolutely scares me. As I said when we started, we've become addicted to government. The government is kind of like the I guess the best way to describe this, is if you have a house, the plans come from the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, kind of layout. The sewer system or the plumbing system would be the federal government, the electrical system, the state government, and the decor and the finish work, that's the churches and the people and society in general. And I'll tell you what, when you overload the sewer system, it stinks, and we've overloaded it. We want them to solve all our problems, and I tell you what, it doesn't work. Just like solving the problems of poverty. Got to be done block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, and it can't be done with massive inputs of money. It gets lost in the bureaucracy. I've seen it. I've worked the system.
As long as we're talking about federal programs, let's talk a little bit about Social Security. Of course, that's another issue that's being discussed by many of the candidates in this particular race as well as the presidential candidates. And there are various solutions proposed for making sure that Social Security remains solvent. One of those is allowing people to take a portion of their Social Security benefits and invest them in the stock market. What do you think of that idea?
At this point, I'm not into that because I want to see the medical savings account set up. So that when you're 65 or so, and your medical bills are prepaid, your insurances are prepaid, you cover what you have. You can, and that whole thing is privately invested. You can use that to supplement Social Security. I don't want to monkey with Social Security right now, and I haven't gotten into it because my major trust and interest is medical health care system. I'm not circumventing the problem. I'm saying let's get this medical health care system squared away. And see what the medical savings account program looks like in terms of down the pike, and then we can talk about Social Security, because I see the two complementing each other.
Do you think we have time to wait to address Social Security?
I think we have 5 and 10 years to wait. We may end up, if we take some of the pressure off of Social Security with the medical health savings accounts, it may work out even better, just leaving things the way they are.
All right. Our next caller is Amber from Farmington. Good morning, Amber.
Hi, good morning. I am so grateful to be hearing what I'm hearing today because you're saying a lot of what I've always felt, that there is no difference between the Democratic and Republican parties. It's very sad to say, and I don't want to sound cynical, but it's like they exist basically to make money, to how much money they can get in their reelection campaign funds. And so it's like we have a democracy that's being bought and paid for. And so, oh, and I read the book you mentioned, written by Jim Hightower.
Oh, it's enjoyable, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I love it. If the gods had meant for us to vote, they would have given us candidates. That is a great book. The only thing I would disagree is about health insurance. I work in a clinic. It's a mental health clinic. And people are afraid of having the government in charge of health care when, in fact, right now, the insurance companies are in charge of health care. Personally, I don't think the government could do worse. I mean, right now, being in charge of health care are insurance companies whose motivation is profit. Not that that's bad, but when it's health care, the motivation should be care. It should not be profit. It should be the bottom. They are concerned about their bottom line. How can we make as much money as possible? Well, the way they make as much money as possible is for people to pay insurance premiums and for them never to actually pay for anyone to see a doctor. In the clinic, basically, I'm a bookkeeper. I try and get insurance companies to pay the therapist for the work that they have done providing care. So maybe I have a biased view of this, but trying to get the insurance companies to reimburse us for the amount of work the therapists do is like pulling teeth.
No, I concur with what you're saying. We have two problems right now, and so what you're saying, if given the present system, is probably 100% correct. We have two problems. One is that this nation never addressed health care, what I'll call mental health care, which I think is a vital ingredient in the whole health care system. And the other thing is we have just a handful of insurance companies driving the whole system. We have a bureaucracy within insurance now that's making the money and not the doctors that used to make the money. You know, we got the system we have because we were concerned that the hospitals and the doctors were making too much. So we transferred that to a handful of bureaucrats with the HMOs and the PPOs and the healthcare system we have driven by a handful of insurance companies. If we had a much more open process, competitive process with insurance companies, and we had multiple insurance companies, that's not just a handful, there is no quick fix and no easy solution. And someone's going to be driving the system. But I'd rather have a competitive private sector drive the system where doctors and nurses might have more input than the system we have today where the input's coming out of bureaucracy. I, like I say, I don't have all the answers in medical health. I just, from what I see, it bothers me. And I think we have to, what I'm putting out is, like I say, open for discussion. But the premise I want is that the states have a certain amount of responsibility. The individuals will have a tremendous amount of responsibility. And I want all the health care needs covered. We don't have that today. But I really appreciate your comments.
All right.
Her concerns are valid.
Our next caller is Teresa from St. Paul. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. I have two questions. One, I'm wondering what Mr. Johnson's thoughts are about the role of government in education and if he has any ideas about how to fix our system. It seems like all we do is throw more money at it. And the other question is concern about affordable housing, particularly in our state. It seems it's a crisis. And one of the problems identified is the cost of property taxes for that owners of rental property have to pay. So those are my questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
Didn't have to make them so tough. those are very solid questions. I hope I can follow. Let's start with housing first of all. I spent some years in real estate a few years back. They used to have an old what they call a 235 program, where if you had $235 down, you could buy a house. The interest you paid was a normal interest rate, except it was subsidized, and it allowed what I'll call middle or lower middle income people into housing. But our emphasis, and just having worked in a little bit in the Phillips neighborhood in South Minneapolis with some friends of mine, I mean, I wasn't a full-time job or anything, but just sitting down discussing the problems and issues. The problem we have is the thrust is right away to get subsidized rent, when indeed if people own their own property, they seem to, you know, take more pride in it or spend more time on it. But the point of real estate taxes and been driven that direction is a real concern. I jokingly say we're not allowed private ownership of private property in this state because if you don't pay your real estate taxes, you don't have it. In other words, we lease our homes and our properties from the government. And somehow that real estate tax structure has to be revamped. And that's a state problem. I don't solve that problem coming at from the national level. I really believe you've heard the governor on many occasions talk about the approach of reducing the pressure on real estate taxes by finding alternatives. So this is a Governor Jesse Ventura issue, and I really have a lot of faith that he's going to move in that direction.
Is that the only issue, though, that is preventing the construction of more affordable housing? Is that particular
issue? Well, one of the problems you have is and you see this, private individuals, I think, can form a little bit of what I'll call a construction company, go into some of these old homes and fix them up for $7,000, maybe $15,000. Whereas the government, with their programs, come in and they fix up the same home and they'll spend $40,000 to $50,000 revamping the same house, and in 3 years the real estate value for sale purposes is the same. So I think if we allow the small, what I'll call contractors, to come in and develop some of these properties and put more emphasis on that structure versus the federal government, I think we'd have more housing available. I have a lot of friends in the rental business, and I watch the headaches they have and the problems they have. And there's a lot of regulation and red tape goes into some of the construction of their homes that I think is unnecessary.
The second part of Teresa's question had to do with the federal role in education.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. there's no quick fix on the educational system. But at the lower levels, there's a lot of bureaucracy that drives the system. And there's not enough emphasis on the participation of the parents. And I know they say what's hard, it can't be done, but that's not really true. I really believe to have a good quality education, you have to have quality teachers, and you have to have parental participation at the lower level. I have no heartache with subsidizing teacher's salary, and I know if you pay a teacher an awful lot, it doesn't necessarily mean you have a good teacher, but there has to be some degree of compensation so that your best and brightest go into teaching. And I really believe that if we could take some of the bureaucracy, and I know we can, out of the classroom and turn our teachers loose, and just from the teachers I know, we'd have a much better environment. At the university level, it's bureaucracy-driven and budget-driven, I realize. And even there, turn the profs loose, let them teach. And
again, do you think there's the federal government should play a role at all in terms of education, setting standards or funding it?
I don't think the federal government should play a role at all in terms of establishing standards or creating regulation. If they want to help, let it be a voucher someplace here or there, but I'd like to see the federal government out of it. I don't see what they add to it other than the bureaucracy.
Uh-huh.
Money's always welcome, but sometimes the conditions that go with it preclude a better environment for the teachers.
Let's talk for a minute about foreign policy issues. We haven't really touched on that at all in the last several minutes that we've been just talking here. You briefly mentioned the missile defense system that President Clinton is considering right now, whether or not to continue funding for it or to scrap it. And tell us again what you feel about that plan.
My first impulse is to scrap it. Not that we shouldn't be defending our country. I'm a real strong believer in national defense. I believe that we have to maintain a strong military posture and a strong economic posture. We're the leaders of the world. My question is, when do you commit this armed forces and when don't you? And I would be a lot less likely to encourage the commitment of forces such as we have in the Balkans or into Africa. Our role in foreign affairs, as I see it, should be more of a mediator of conflict and not an intervener. And once you commit combat troops, you're no longer a mediator. You're committed. I just have a heartache with the way we've been abusing our military forces and not necessarily in our national interest. I look even at the Persian Gulf War, a big war that we won. But my question is, could we have prevented the war? There's an old Chinese theory that, the greatest general is not one who won 100 battles, but one who prevented 100 wars. And our objective should be to, try to prevent conflict. And I really believe had we been forceful enough prior to the Saddam Hussein's movement into Kuwait, we could have prevented it. On the other hand, maybe our intelligence is so bad that we didn't know what was going on. And that I can't argue with, because when intelligence is so bad, you blow up a Chinese embassy in Bucharest or in Belgrade, when you blow up a civilian facility in Sudan and claim it was making gas warfare weapons, when you do some of the stupid things we've done, I have to question what we have for military intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another area of concern of mine. But in the area of foreign affairs, we came out of Vietnam. There's a lot of lessons to be learned, and not that the cause wasn't right, but it was like a bullfight. And this is, we have to be aware of what we're doing and when. And I say like a bullfight. The North Vietnamese were the matador, we were the bull, and the Viet Cong we chased all over South Vietnam was the cape.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they wore us down and wiped us out. And that was because our politicians had no vision and understanding of the nature of war. War, to me, the ultimate insanity. How do you prevent it? That should be the thrust.
And just a real brief final question about Cuba, because Congress is looking at relaxing some of our sanctions against Cuba. What do you feel about that?
I don't believe in the sanctions in Cuba. I never did, even though they were an enemy. I'd open up the trade. I'd open up trade with Iraq. I don't think it's a viable course of action. In the long run, it's counterproductive. And we use the argument, we want to go into China and trade with China. That's a totalitarian state. They haven't done very well by the students who protested. They ran over them with tanks. And yet we're talking about trade with China. And they're saying, well, that's going to help us in the long run to communicate. Well, if that's the case with China, it sure is with Iraq and Cuba.
Mr. Johnson, you have about 1 minute for just a parting comment.
Well, we have some problems in this country. It's a fantastic nation. Some areas we have to really look at is civil rights. We have to look at our own hearts. All men are created equal. We better look at the fact that we're Americans first, and then start talking about diversity. We don't do enough of talking about, we're all Americans. What color is an American? And we have to get excited about who we are as Americans. And the other thing is we have to wean ourselves off this addiction to government. The community and the churches and the families have to take a more responsible role, and I think we're headed in that direction. And I think we can clean up the political mess, and the political mess is not necessarily the politicians, but the two political parties that we have. And it's those two parties that give us access to our politicians. Unfortunately, the two parties have become corrupted. And that's about all I have to say.
Well, and we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, I sure appreciate the time, Melanie.
You're very welcome. Buford Johnson is Independence Party candidate for the U.S. Senate. You're listening to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Melanie Summers, sitting in for Gary Eichten.
High prescription drug prices have become a big issue in this year's Senate race, prompting one candidate to bring some seniors to Canada for cheaper drugs. I'm Perry Finelli. We'll hear from the candidates and some senior citizens and have the rest of the news tomorrow on Morning Edition from 4 to 9 here on Minnesota Public Radio, KNWFM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
The Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 24th of July, 2000. It's the birthday of Bella Abzug, born in the Bronx, New York, 1920. She became a lawyer, represented union workers, defended leftist cases, and served three terms in the House of Representatives. It's the birthday of mystery writer John D. MacDonald, born in Sharon, Pennsylvania, 1916. His famous detective character, Travis McGee, first appeared in 1964 in a book called The Deep Blue Goodbye. One of MacDonald's trademarks was the use of a color in the title of each of his books, Dresser in Indigo, The Girl in the Plain Brown Wrapper, The Lonely Silver Rain, and so on. John D. MacDonald, who wrote every day for 7 to 9 hours, taking a break for lunch and another at the cocktail hour, who said, "Most of my published novels are of the folk dancing category. The steps, the patterns, traditionally imperative, the retributions obligatory." It's the birthday of Zelda Sayre Fitzgerald, born in Montgomery, Alabama, 1900, who married F. Scott Fitzgerald in 1920, and who wrote her one novel, Save Me the Waltz, 1932, about a Southern belle who marries a flamboyant writer in order to escape her father's suffocating morality. Her husband becomes fabulously successful in the novel, but then withdraws into his art, making him every bit as distant as her father had been. It's the birthday of aviator Amelia Earhart, born in Atchison, Kansas, 1897. She was the first woman to fly alone across the Atlantic in 1932, and 5 years later disappeared in the Central Pacific on her way flying around the world. It's the birthday of poet Robert Graves in London, 1895, who wrote novels to support himself so that he could write poetry, which was his real passion. He said, "Prose books are the show dogs I breed and sell to support my cat." He wrote historical novels such as I, Claudius, and Claudius the God, and a memoir about World War I, Goodbye to All That. Robert Graves, who said, "9/10 of all poetic literature is the result either of vulgar careerism or of a poet trying to keep his hand in. Most poets are dead by their late 20s. It was on this day in 1847, Brigham Young looked out over the present site of Salt Lake City and said, "Enough, this is the place." And it's the birthday of novelist Alexandre Dumas, the elder, born in France, 1802, the author of The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers. Here's a poem for today by Robert Graves on his birthday, A Slice of Wedding Cake. Why have such scores of lovely gifted girls married impossible men? Simple self-sacrifice may be ruled out, and missionary endeavor 9 times out of 10. Repeat, impossible men, not merely rustic, foul-tempered, or depraved, dramatic foils chosen to show the world how well women behave and always have behaved. Impossible men, idle, illiterate, self-pitying, dirty, sly, for whose appearance, even in city parks, excuses must be made to casual passers-by. Has God's supply of tolerable husbands fallen, in fact, so low? Or do I always overvalue woman at the expense of man? Do I? It might be so. A poem by Robert Graves, A Slice of Wedding Cake. Used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac for Monday, July 24th, made possible by 21NorthMaine.com, where book lovers find more than 10 million used, rare, and antiquarian books on the web at 21NorthMaine.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
How should the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness be managed? Log on to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, take the poll, and leave your opinion. Listen to our Main Street radio broadcast on the subject from Ely on Friday. Find out more at Minnesota.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. It's partly cloudy, 6 degrees at KNOW-FM, 91.1, Minneapolis-St. Paul. Twin Cities weather for today calls for partly sunny skies with a high temperature in the mid-80s. Tonight, we have a 60% chance of some showers and thunderstorms with lows around 65. And then tomorrow, variable clouds.